Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Richard Crane, and I represent the appellants Irene Neighbors and Christine Fielder in this matter. Also with me at counsel table is Peter Anderson, who is the trial counsel on this matter. Your Honors, I'd like to reserve approximately 5 minutes for rebuttal. I know that I'll be responsible for keeping track of my own time on that. What I'd like to do, Your Honors, is basically cover the issues in the same order that I covered them in the brief, and that would be the issue as to whether the trial court was in error in not granting the plaintiff's motion in limine regarding the time that plaintiffs retained their counsel, and then the second argument was the issue as to whether the trial court erred in regarding Jerry Ogden's testimony and not ruling that Mr. Ogden should not be allowed to testify as an actual witness. I want to first apologize to the court and to counsel for the lateness of the endorsement, the citational supplemental authority. I did not actually become aware of this additional authority until right before it was filed. I became aware of this additional authority through a post on the Colorado Trial Lawyers Association listserv that talked about this issue and how an attorney had gotten this ruling from Judge Frick in the Denver District Court. And he posted Judge Frick's ruling in the transcript of the Judge Frick's ruling, and so that's why there's the lateness in filing of the supplemental authority. Your Honors, as I stated in the briefs, this is essentially an issue of first impression in the state of Colorado regarding the whether the defense should be allowed to present evidence as to when plaintiffs retained their attorney on the matter. And I think the ruling from Judge Frick is very instructive and persuasive on this issue. And you'll note that this was actually in the context of a discovery issue of whether the plaintiff's attorney had instructed his client not to answer the question of when her client had retained her attorney in the matter. And then they took a break and called Judge Frick to get a ruling on that issue. And Judge Frick ruled that just as a matter of discovery, that this issue was not even reasonably calculated to lead to discovery of evidence, of admissible evidence. So in this proceeding, we're talking about whether the trial court should have allowed the evidence at trial, which is obviously a lot different standard. But Judge Frick, even in the standard of whether it's reasonably calculated to lead to discovery of admissible evidence, ruled that type of question is not reasonably calculated to lead to discovery of admissible evidence.
Well, counsel, was it admissible to show bias in this case?
Your Honor, as I stated in the briefs, we're not really questioning the fact that the defense have a right to cross-examine regarding the bias issue. And in fact, they did do that type of cross-examination. They cross-examined Dr. Haas, the chiropractor, as to his relationship with Mr. Anderson, who was trial counsel. And they cross-examined both plaintiffs as to their retention of Dr. Haas. And that was over no objection from plaintiff's attorney in this case. So we're not questioning the fact that they have a right to cross-examine regarding bias of the expert witness and the relationship of the expert witness, Dr. Haas, and the trial counsel, Mr. Anderson. And in fact, they did do that. But what we're saying is there's a difference between just cross-examining an expert on the relationship of trial counsel or cross-examining the plaintiffs as to how they happen to choose that particular chiropractor or how they happen to choose that particular attorney and the actual date that the attorney was retained.
The time,
exactly, Your Honor.
Did you ask for a limited instruction?
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Anderson filed a motion in limine on this issue, and the trial court denied that motion in limine.
Nope. I think the question was, did you request a limiting instruction?
Oh, I apologize, Your Honor. No, I do not. I do not believe that the limiting instruction was requested after the trial court made its ruling on the motion of limiting.
How was it, if your argument is limited to questions regarding the exact timing, my understanding of the timing here is that the plaintiffs sought medical treatment relatively soon. They had to get an appointment with the chiropractor, and that took a couple of weeks. They met with him, and then perhaps a week or two later, he referred them to an attorney. He gave them a list of attorneys. So we're talking about a period of time of, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks perhaps since the accident. What I'm having trouble with is, how does that make your client look bad? I mean, wouldn't one be expected to retain an attorney relatively soon after an accident causing injuries?
Well, Your Honor, one would hope that a jury would see it that way, but I think they're realistically, jurors don't look at it that way.
Well, they know your client has a lawyer. He's in their courtroom. So.
Of course, Your Honor. But as the cases that I've cited point out, and I think as Judge Frick points out in her ruling, basically that this type of questioning is designed to try to paint plaintiffs as greedy or avaricious in the case, and basically trying to imply that that's the reason that they sought medical treatment is because their lawyer told them to, and that.
But here we don't have that fact circumstance. Here we have a circumstance where they go to the chiropractor first, and then the lawyer. So we don't have a lawyer referring somebody to a chiropractor, which might give rise to that inference you're talking about.
Well,
we have the opposite.
And Your Honor, I think that was my point. I think in the briefs is that was the timing of it. So the trial court's ruling was, and I'll quote from the trial court's ruling on denying motion in limine. The trial court's ruling was, says, quote, when counsel for plaintiff was retained compared to when plaintiffs were allegedly injured, compared to when plaintiffs originally sought medical or chiropractic care, and compared to who recommended that plaintiffs retain their counsel are probably proper subjects for testimony. And as I stated before, we're not trying to argue that they don't have a right to bring out the timing of when the plaintiff sought treatment versus when the accident occurred, and the relationship between one of the treatment providers, Dr. Haas, and Mr. Anderson. What we're trying to say is that they don't get to question the plaintiffs regarding the timing of when they hired their attorney. And I think Judge Frick, in her ruling in the Carlisle versus Lay case that I cite quite extensively in the briefs, talks about why this is prejudicial and why it's inadmissible. And it's because basically it's plaintiffs have a right to an attorney in this case. And when you're using this type of testimony, it's basically trying to comment on, basically it's infringing on the injured party's right to retain an attorney. I think it'd be similar to like in a criminal case when a prosecutor would try to comment on a defendant's exercising his right to remain silent. At trial, well, of course, the defendant has this right to remain silent, but commenting on it is prejudicial because all they're doing is exercising their rights.
Well, commenting on it is determined to be a violation of the Constitution. We don't have that problem here in a civil case. I mean, the rationale of those cases is not that the testimony is irrelevant. The rationale is that commenting on silence violates the Fifth Amendment.
Well, I agree, Your Honor, and it's probably not the greatest analysis in the world, criminal versus civil. But the cases, the Carlisle versus Lay case and the other cases that Carlisle relies upon, they really are quite emphatic that this type of testimony is irrelevant, and in fact it's so irrelevant it's prejudicial as a matter of law. That's the way the Carlisle versus Lay court put it, is that they first determined that that it was inadmissible, it was not relevant, and then they went and cited some Texas authority on that.
And those cases have to do with the precise issue of the timing.
Yes, Your Honor.
Seeking an attorney?
Yes, Your Honor, they did. The Carlisle versus Lay case and the Texas cases cited by Carlisle all had to do with the timing of it. And
well, in Carlisle, the issue was a little different, wasn't it? Because the accident involved, the incident involved, had claimed the life of the plaintiff's son, as I recall the facts of that case.
That is correct.
And so, in that case, it looks like the evidence was being used to show that because they hired an attorney so quickly, plaintiffs were more interested in capitalizing on their son's death than in grieving their son's death. We really don't have that kind of wrinkle here, do we?
Your Honor, I'm not sure that was actually the context of that case. It was a wrongful death case, and the holding was basically that it was irrelevant, that type of testimony was irrelevant as to when the plaintiffs retained their attorney. But I don't really recall it being in the context of, well, you're more concerned with hiring a lawyer than you are grieving with your son. That's not really the way I recall the context of the ruling from the court. My understanding of the ruling from the court is that this type of evidence is just not relevant because it basically is it infringing upon a party's right to retain an attorney.
Okay, so let's go back. Let's assume that's the case. And let's assume that the court should not have allowed that. While the court could have allowed the testimony as to the referral by the chiropractor, that it should not have allowed testimony as to the precise date the referral took place. What is the prejudice? How do you articulate the prejudice? Because we have to determine whether the error is harmless or not.
Oh, I understand that, Your Honor, and I guess I have to refer to the Carlaw case once again, when they basically are finding as a matter of law that it's prejudice based on this type of questioning. That it's when you're talking about basically evidence that's goes against a person's right to retain their attorney, that type of evidence will be deemed prejudicial as a matter of law.
But that's just a say-so. That's not an explanation. That's not logic. I'm looking for some logic. Why is it prejudicial? Because I got to tell you, I can see the reverse situation or different situations more prejudicial. You don't hire a lawyer for 2 years, okay? Seems to me if you don't hire a lawyer for 2 years, then the inference to be raised, well, you didn't think there'd been any wrongful conduct. So here, you've got a party who appears to behave as one would normally behave. They're in an accident at which they're not at fault, that's not disputed. And they hire a lawyer within a few weeks. How is that logically prejudicial?
Well, Your Honor, the theme of the defendant's case, basically the theme of their defense in the case was, well, first of all, they admitted liability. So the theme of their defense was, yes, the defendant is Mr. Reynolds was liable in the accident, but this accident did not cause any of either plaintiff's injuries whatsoever. It just didn't cause any injuries. And that's in fact what the jury's verdict was, that they found that neither plaintiff had sustained any injuries caused by this accident. And the defendant's attorney in both his opening statement and the cross-examination and in his closing argument emphasized this timing of when plaintiffs retained their attorney. And then the follow-up on to that was, and by the way, none of this treatment was related to the accident. So therefore, the inference is that, hey, this is all just a trumped up thing here. Plaintiffs run out and get their attorney as soon as they can. They go see this chiropractor that the attorney's hooked in with. The chiropractor says all the injuries were related to the accident. These thousands of dollars are all related to the accident. This is all just a trumped up thing here. And the jury obviously believed that.
How do we know that? How do we know the jury believed that this was all a trumped up thing? There was expert testimony involved.
Well, Your Honor, the expert testimony went only as to Ms. Dehnbert, did not go to Ms. Fielder. The IME that the doctor conducted was only on Ms. Dehnbert, and she gave no testimony whatsoever as to Ms. Fielder, whether the treatment that Ms. Fielder received was caused by this accident. Your Honor, I see I have just a little under a minute, so unless the court has any further questions, I guess I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Actually, counsel, if you feel the need to answer that question, go ahead. I'm going to give you 2 minutes on an additional 2 minutes on rebuttal anyway.
Okay, I appreciate that, Your Honor. Well, I think Judge Jones deserves an answer to his question. As I said before, the expert testimony the defendant put on went only as to his neighbor. The doctor said, based upon my examination, she did this, what they call an IME, and of Ms. Neighbor, and said based on her examination of Ms. Neighbor, she found that none of the damages she was claiming, none of the treatment she was claiming, were caused by this particular accident. But that was only as to Ms. Neighbor. There was no testimony whatsoever as to Ms. Fielder on that particular issue. But the jury still found that none of Ms. Fielder's injuries and damages were caused by this particular accident.
I understand your response. I think I was referring more to the testimony of Mr. Ogden, which I understand you didn't get to today, but his testimony that this was a very low-speed accident, and one could infer from that the injuries that were complained of could not have occurred from such a low-speed accident. Wouldn't that be a reasonable inference that the jury accepted Mr. Ogden's testimony?
Well, Mr. Ogden's testimony was simply as to the speed of the accident. He gave no testimony whatsoever. In fact, the court barred him from giving any testimony as to this type of a low-speed collision could not have caused damages or injuries. He was not allowed to give that type of testimony. So his only testimony was as to the speed of the vehicles involved. I suppose the jury could have said, well, I'm going to believe in Mr. Ogden's testimony. But the speed was, I think his testimony was 3.5 miles per hour. I'm going to believe that. And then they say, well, in our opinion, a 3.5 mile per hour accident could not have caused these injuries. I suppose the jury could have used that type of analysis. Whether they did or not, who knows, but I suppose they could have. But,
thank you, counsel. Thank you. You'll have 2 minutes on rebuttal.
Okay.
You have 17 minutes if you want to use 17 minutes.
Yeah.
Don't start though until we get the 17 minutes set up for you. No?
All right.
Okay.
May it please court, my name is Sharon Sharrock, bar number 36969. I'm with the Acasa Law Firm, and we represent the defendant in the underlying action, Douglas Reynolds. Your Honor, I'll just jump right into the inference by opposing counsel that there were no facts supportive of finding no damages to the plaintiffs, and that there were no causation issues regarding Mr. Reynolds and the negligence. Point of fact, plaintiffs' counsel worked very, very hard to keep from evidence two photographs, one of a defendant's vehicle and one of the back of plaintiff's vehicle, showing virtually no damage whatsoever. Those are located at record 1542 and 1544. And in fact, trial counsel blew up both of those pictures and used them throughout trial. In addition, Your Honor, there were no complaints of injury at the scene of the accident. The police report bore that out.
But let me ask you a question. Did your side use the fact of the timing of the meeting or appointment of counsel as to infer that this is further evidence of trumped up charges?
Your Honor, I wouldn't say that was the point. However, we do acknowledge that we found that it was exactly relevant in the timing of it. As Your Honor had pointed out, the timing of when someone retains counsel may or may not be relevant, or at least the defense counsel's standpoint. For instance, if...
Then why was it relevant here?
Because of the relationship between plaintiff's counsel and the retained expert, Dr. Haas, in this case, and also because of the facts surrounding the accident, Your Honor, the fact that plaintiffs did not complain of injury at the scene. They waited more than 2 weeks before they received any kind of medical treatment. Thereafter, within a couple of weeks of getting treatment from Dr. Haas, they then retained plaintiff's counsel. Plaintiff's counsel then turned around and designated Dr. Haas as a retained expert in the field of accident reconstruction. Dr. Haas ended up incurring $63,000 in medical treatment of both Ms. Nebert and Ms. Fielder over the span of 6.5 years, which accounted for roughly 70% of all of plaintiff's medical bills in this circumstance. And so given the timing of all of this and given the reciprocal relationship between plaintiff's counsel and Dr. Haas, we felt that it was necessary to show that there was in fact a relationship which would go to the bias of Dr. Haas. In addition, Your Honor, we did find case law that said that under certain circumstances, evidence of specifically when plaintiffs retain their counsel is relevant to show a potential bias of the plaintiffs themselves in circumstances where there's suggestion of trumped up claims in this case. Now, we have a case where pictures bore out virtually no physical damage to the vehicles. There was no complaints of pain, no treatment for more than 2 weeks. And thereafter, at trial, plaintiffs sought roughly $3 million in damages. One could argue, certainly, that the initial facts of the accident, plus the fact that we had Dr. Ogden, who was testifying as to the impact speed of the accident itself, could show that the plaintiffs had blown up their claims. And certainly the jury is instructed at the beginning of trial, and again before they go back to deliberate, that they're to weigh all evidence on their own and not to give specific weight, more weight to one piece of evidence than another. They can give the evidence 100% credence or no credence whatsoever. And so there was certainly enough evidence to suggest that plaintiffs were perhaps caught up in this treatment and in relationship with plaintiff and Dr. Haas, such that by the end of it, there were $3 million in claim damages.
I don't think that the plaintiffs are contesting your client's right to explore the degree of relationship between the chiropractor and the attorney, the fact that there was a relationship, even the fact that there was a referral. What they're objecting to is the timing. Why is the specific timing here relevant in this case?
Your Honor,
and what is it relevant to show?
Your Honor, if the retention would have happened a year into Dr. Haas's treatment, then certainly there wouldn't be that nexus or that relationship where it'd be harder to show that there's a reciprocal relationship between plaintiff's counsel and Dr. Haas. In this circumstance, they retained plaintiff's counsel within a couple weeks of their initial treatment with Dr. Haas. Thereafter, he treated them for roughly $63,000 worth of damages, of which he had a lien, or on which he had a lien, and he was only going to get paid if plaintiffs recovered in that case. The timing of that was particularly important, and without that piece of information and the fact that the retention occurred and then all of a sudden all of these charges then occur, that would have been an incomplete picture in this circumstance. And so we would argue that under these specific facts, that the retention and the date of that retention was specifically important. And as Your Honor had referenced too, plaintiffs had the option of, or had the ability, I guess, to ask for a limiting instruction that the relevance of when counsel was retained would only be used to show specifically the relationship between counsel and Dr. Haas, whether they never requested such a limiting instruction. And so it was used for any kind of inference that anyone would gather from that information. And
let me see if I can shortcut this. I'm still trying to get my hands around the relevance here. Are you saying that the timing is relevant because of fees the doctor incurred after he referred them to a lawyer? That as to those fees, he gets paid only if they recover in a lawsuit?
Yes.
So the idea would be his bias is called into question because he feels he can run up the fees, if you will, and his lawyer will make sure that he gets
Well, I don't know what necessarily he would feel about the circumstance, Your Honor, but I would certainly say that in that circumstance where he gets an attorney involved, he says to the patients, here's a list of attorneys. And to be noted, specifically Ms. Fielder had said that Dr. Haas had referred her to plaintiff's counsel. That was watered down in trial. But at the time when the court made the motion in limine ruling, that was the evidence that we had before us, was that it was unequivocal that Dr. Haas had referred plaintiffs to their counsel. But back to the point is that thereafter, a lien is executed and there's no recovery unless plaintiffs recover. And in litigation, then this stalls for 6.5 years, and $63,000 in medical bills are incurred. And oh, by the way, he has been retained as an expert in accident reconstruction. So there were layers of this relationship, Your Honor, and it started with within a month of the accident in question. Your Honor, I would distinguish, as I did in the brief, to the cases that plaintiffs cited and that they relied on, Carlisle specifically, and actually Martinez as well. Now they're being dealt with a referral relationship between the treating physicians and plaintiff's counsel. Point of fact, the wrongful death case of Carlisle didn't even deal with an expert at all. So I think that those cases are distinguishable in the present case, because this is a layered application of the relevance of when counsel was retained in this specific instance. Another thing I would point out, Your Honor, is evidence in any kind of trial is going to be prejudicial to one case or another. The question, though, is whether it's unduly prejudicial. And we believe that the trial court properly weighed the analysis of 403 and gave the relevance of when plaintiff's counsel was retained its maximum probative value and its minimal prejudicial effect in this case. And while it may have been prejudicial with perhaps some inferences regarding plaintiff's litigious nature, again, that could have been an inference, although that was never something suggested by defense counsel. It was not unduly prejudicial given the circumstance or the totality of the facts which that particular piece fit into.
So it was part of the trial strategy to show that they were being opportunistically litigious. Would you agree with that?
I would say, no, Your Honor, that that was not part of the trial strategy, that they were being opportunistically litigious. I would say that we were pointing out that perhaps they were making more out of what their claims were than what originally was there. In other words, they were making the claims bigger than what they initially looked to be in the circumstance. And certainly the pictures, the expert evidence that we had put forth, and all the other pieces of the puzzle bore that out, that this case got larger than what plaintiffs were, I think.
Well, could you have established your theory of the case without that specific piece of the timing of when they contacted and retained the attorney?
Your Honor, I guess we could have. However, again, that would have provided an incomplete picture. And I think that that additional piece of information was critical to provide the whole picture of the relationship between counsel and Dr. Haas. Again, and another reason is because of the fact that all of the charges in this case occurred after retention of counsel, and despite this minor nature of this accident, ballooned to a $3 million case. With regard to expert disclosure, Your Honor, we would first argue that plaintiffs did not preserve their issue for appeal. The cases cited by plaintiffs in both their opening brief and in their reply brief actually deal with cases where counsel had conducted some kind of follow-on discovery of the experts in the case, whether those were requests for production of documents, whether they were depositions. There were motions to strike filed, motions to exclude evidence under every single one of the cases cited by plaintiffs. And so in this circumstance, Your Honors, we would argue that because plaintiffs waited until the 11th hour of trial, and specifically the fourth day of a five-day trial, before making an objection and requesting the sanction of witness preclusion, that plaintiffs did not preserve their issue for appeal. Should the court find it persuasive that they did in fact preserve their issue for appeal, we would argue that Mr. Ogden fully disclosed his testimony, and that plaintiffs had before them three full reports within 13 months of trial. And those three reports reflected what Mr. Ogden did testify to at trial. Now, contrary to what plaintiffs argue in their briefs, Dr. Ogden did in fact refer to in all three of his reports the SMAC simulation model. Now, that is in fact a simulation model. It is a program that is available for free on the National Transportation Board and for any kind of forensic engineer. That is something that is rarely used to look at accident reconstruction. And the reference to all three of those is in the record at page 1567 for Mr. Ogden's first report, at record page 1573 for his second report, and at record 1583 for his third report. And in fact, at page 1583, the SMAC simulation model was discussed in some detail because apparently Dr. Croft was not familiar with the SMAC simulation model. The argument, as I understand it, is that because Mr. Ogden showed up with a binder that was voluminous, that it was obvious that he had not disclosed something within that binder that should have been disclosed pursuant to CRCP 26A2. However, CRCP 26A2 says that for a retained expert, a report or summary shall be provided to the opposing side with notice of the person's opinions and the bases therefore. Again, Mr. Ogden did not testify outside of anything that was contained within his report. There was no discussion about I did 175,000 calculations and go into detail about these calculations at all. He indeed referenced SMAC. He did indeed say that he did cross-checks. However, he also referenced he did calculations and he did cross-checks within his three reports that were produced and disclosed timely to plaintiffs on the other side. In addition, Your Honor, we would argue that this idea that Mr. Ogden obviously relied on these calculations and therefore should have disclosed them, we would say that CRCP 26B contemplates additional discovery. Again, that is also contemplated in all the case law cited by both sides to this issue. And plaintiffs failed to do that in the circumstance. That follow-on discovery could have yielded any kind of calculations. However, they were not prejudiced in any way because Dr. Croft did in fact refute every single one of Mr. Ogden's opinions in this case. And I see that I have 13 seconds, so Your Honor.
Did the witness contradict the calculations? Did he say he had the opportunity to make, to do the calculations or review the calculations of Mr. Ogden?
Your Honor, Dr. Croft didn't say that he needed the calculations or that he was in any way prejudiced, that he didn't have calculations. He said that he did calculations himself. he faulted the calculations and specifically SMAC by Mr. Ogden, and that reference, I've got that referenced as well. The record, Your Honor, at page 3734, line 6 through page 3735, line 14, Dr. Croft specifically referenced SMAC.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
I take it, Mr. Anderson, that you're going to do the rebuttal?
Your Honor, is it possible that, do I need to do the full rebuttal?
Well, you have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. 033067, Your Honors, I'm humbled to be before you. The first issue is they got to say when, and we didn't get to say why. After the crash, they spoke with State Farm representatives, and because of those interactions, they sought counsel. The jury didn't get to hear the whole story, and they were prejudiced by not being able to explain the why. They hired an attorney when they did. The second issue.
Did they try to explain why? And were they precluded from explaining why?
During the motions hearing, the motion to eliminate hearing, it was very clear that we were, the judge ruled that the testimony of the hiring counsel was going to come in. I know, I haven't done that many trials, but I know that mentioning insurance and contacting the defense insurance representative is not fair game. And so when I listened to the judge during the hearings of the motion limited to take away, to not discuss the timing, I respected the court's ruling, I followed the rules as the judge set forth. And so I hope I answered that question. The issue of insurance and speaking with the defense representatives is not to an issue. The second issue is the 5-inch blue binder surprise. When we got to court, this doctor had 5 inches, and when I opened it up, it had pages on pages of calculations written, computer printouts, articles. There were simulation calculations. We requested his entire file in discovery, and Dr. Croft could not, if we had that information, which we believe should have been disclosed, would have been able to run his own calculations. And lastly, the plaintiffs, they do owe the balance of the providers, and they come from modest means in Weld County, but they are making payments to their providers.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case will stand submitted, and opinion will issue in due course.